Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel and proud member of the Robots Radio podcast network. My name is Arimithius, and this week we're talking about one of the simplest in some senses and yet most complex races on Tamriel. We are looking at a culture that has shifted and changed throughout its whole history in more ways than one, and I think is just really part of an ongoing argument about what it actually is. This week, we're asking, what are the Bosmer? Before we get to that, though, I'd just like to say thank you ever so much to Luke and Michael, who have signed up to become my newest patrons since the last episode. So thank you ever so much for signing up, guys. I really appreciate the support that you guys are giving me, and I hope that you're enjoying access to the notes that I'm making for each episode. I also wanted to say thank you to Future Disco, who dropped me some money on Ko-fi recently. Thank you ever so much for that, Future Disco. It's much appreciated. If you want to get exclusive access to my notes and get early access to the content that I make, then you can sign up at patreon.com/writteninuncertainty. And if you want to just literally drop me a little tip here or there, you can go to ko-fi.com/Arimithius. That's ko-fi/Arimithius, and sign up there. Thank you ever so much to everyone who's supporting the show, by the way. It's as I've said before, it's just absolutely fantastic that you think this content is good enough to throw money at. Thank you ever so much. I really appreciate all the support I get from you guys. And before we get to the Bosmer, and before we get even to network news, I'm forgetting my order here. I wanted to go into an email that comes a bit out of the depths of time from William, who I think it's got stuck in his outbox for quite a while, because there's a note at the bottom talking about how he's going to sign up to be a patron, and he's been a patron for a good long while now. So this is a little bit behind, but I wanted to read this email anyway and just respond to it on here, because I think it raises some really interesting questions. So, hi Arimithius, been enjoying your podcast after finding it recently. I was listening to your episode about the towers just now and had a few ideas regarding them and their connection to the tower. I'm not really involved in the TES lore community, so forgive me if this is all something you've heard before, but I've never heard my conception of the towers mentioned anywhere, so I thought you might find it interesting. It comes up in a few places within TES lore. I'm thinking specifically the truth and sequence, but I'm sure there are other places, that the process of naming a thing is the process of separation. I is the name of the self. It is the self-given signifier that differentiates the individual from the undifferential being of Anu, assuming my monist interpretation of Anu is anything resembling accurate. I am of the opinion that the tower is the cosmic eye of existence, or possibly of Lorcan, given his ties to Mundus itself and his potential status as the space god. The tower is the embodiment of the I Am that separated Lorcan, or perhaps all the Aedra, from the beings from which they emanate, assuming Padme and Anu be considered separate beings. Likewise, the towers are lesser eyes. They are the embodiment of the collective sense of separate identity of these cultures that have flocked them and gathered around them. The unique cultural identities of Tamriel are further differentiation and separations created by lesser emanations of the cosmic I Am of the Tower. This is why the Numidium, the Tower of the Dwemer, is in my mind something of an anti-tower. If any I statement could be expected of the Dwemer, rather than I Am, it surely would be I Am Not. Rather than affirming the existence of the Dwemer and their place in the Arabis in a reflection of the tower, the Numidium instead, as an anti-tower, existed to refute it. This is why Numidium is capable of being weaponized. If I Am Not can be proven true, so can neither are you. My interpretation is then that the towers are lesser copies of the tower, as they were made by further subgradiated beings than the original, but ultimately serve the same purpose. To exist as the embodiment of the I that differentiates one from the undifferentiated monad of Anu. That's my explanation to the culture living around them, and for how/why the towers seem to reflect that identity with them. This is in line, in my opinion, with the reality-affirming nature of the towers, as they shape the reality of those for whom they are the embodiment of the separating I am. I is the name of the self. The tower is the symbol of many different towers, many different eyes. Man, trying to communicate a plural of I is a pain. There is a relationship between the self and the symbol of self, between I and the tower, hence why the two resemble one another. Anyway, I hope you found my little ramble interesting. Absolutely, William. It was an absolute pleasure to read, and I think I agree with you for the most part. It's a perspective that I've not seen before. I've seen expressions of the towers as being connected to different cultures and expressive of those cultures, but never in terms of the towers being little eyes, as in I being different from another, being different from another I, and so on. The difference between I and you and so on being explored is an angle I haven't seen anywhere else. But this absolutely seems to be something that makes sense with the way that the towers are, and particularly the way that the towers seem to be tailored to amend their localized reality, if you like, as well as it being the I am not as the expression of a culture that didn't seem to think that they existed properly. The other towers being expressions of a culture and reshaping the land around them as an expression of who they are is a really neat idea, and it reaffirms that idea of that I that you've talked about, the I versus you and so on. And you're right that the notion of I and I am not is something beyond just the truth in sequence. That's highlighted by Vivek when Z talks about Sithis, and Sithis as the beginning of all true houses and that sort of thing, because you can only have houses when you start separating peoples into different groups, which is also tying back to this idea of the towers being expressions of a culture and so on. So just thinking about that then, and I think it's possibly not an accident that Lokan is the one that sees the tower, Lokan as the child of Sithis in particular, and the notion of I as differentiated from both you and everything means that you have that sense of radical realization of the self, and the towers, I think, are absolutely that expression of the radical realization of who people are as a culture rather than as an individual. And I'm not totally sure I'm on board with the idea of the towers themselves being the things that determine what that culture is, or the converse, actually, that the culture has an effect on the tower. I think it's a somewhere between the two. We've got evidence for both, really, because you've got the Dwemer who went to Red Mountain, who went to the Red Tower, and came out with a completely different result in building the new Midium as the Dunmer did when they went to Red Tower. Likewise, the Aelids and the Cyrodiils came up with different cultures when they went to White Gold Tower. So there is some measure of the culture expressing their own will on the tower. And you've also got the Direnni not really interacting too much with Adamantia. They make it their home base and they look after it, but it doesn't really seem to reflect them quite so much as it does the other cultures that have towers, and it drives them to a degree. Perhaps the idea of the mystery of the Zero Stone driving the Direnni to something greater and greater is something that has some weight there. I did talk about something like that in the Direnni cast that I did, and it's certainly something that seems to be the case when you look at the text one, but I think there's enough evidence to say that there's a symbiotic relationship between the tower and, or between any given tower and the culture around it. They both influence one another to a degree, and that interplay is what creates the land around it, because the self both determines the I, and the environment around it determines the I, which is actually something we're going to be talking about in this particular episode with Bosmer. It's not directly related to the Tao, but it will come up. So thank you ever so much for your email, William. It arrived at pretty much the right time for consideration with this particular topic, because I think it relates quite heavily to how the Bosmer see themselves. So thank you again, William, and keep in touch. And if you want to send me an email and let me know a question or just a point you want to make and have read out on the show, drop me an email at writtenanduncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. And now for some quick network news. We have a new show on the Robots Radio Network. It is called The Bare Minimum. It's a new show about Bethesda and everything that goes on with Bethesda. Just some people chatting about those news, offering different perspectives on it, that sort of thing. So go check it out. I imagine that there's been a lot for them to talk about with the acquisition and so on. And that was a brilliant way to kind of kick off the show. So go and check them out if you want to get the scoop on all things Bethesda and presumably ZeniMax as well. I don't know for sure on that one, but I think that it would certainly be within scope. And one last pointer from me. This will be the last Written Uncertainty of 2020. It is dropping probably in mid-November, but it's going to be the last one for the year. I have had quite a dreadful time keeping up with my schedule that I want to have this podcast on and making sure that things are well researched enough. This is already run late, and this had several weeks more time than I technically had allotted to it, because quite a bit of the time filled up with goings on in my life outside of The Elder Scrolls and gaming and so on. So this is going to be the last one for 2020 to make sure that I can thoroughly pad out all of the topics that I have in mind for next year with enough content, get digging up those researches. And if you're a patron, I will be posting multiple notes at once, more or less, into the Patreon account. So keep an eye on those. And if you want to sign up for Patreon as well, then by all means do, and you can see those notes. I will be pausing the Patreon payouts because I'm not going to be giving podcasts until I feel that I'm ready to send all this stuff out. So that will hopefully resume in January, but I'll have to see how it goes. Keep an eye on the Written and Uncertainty Discord and Twitter for that. I am at Arimithius on Twitter, and I will be posting any updates on the status of the podcast there, as well as putting things into the Written and Uncertainty Discord server. There's links to all of this in the show notes, by the way. And with that, I think we should actually get to the Bosmer. Firstly, my usual disclaimer here. This is my understanding of the Bosmer and how they work. This is definitely not a comprehensive and absolutely true account of the Bosmer. I may have missed things, I may be getting stuff wrong, and there may be stuff coming out in the future that contradicts this. I could be looking at things entirely the wrong way. And if you have other opinions about the Bosmer and other thoughts about how they work, please, please, please let me know. I'd absolutely love to hear from you. As I said earlier, you can email me at writtenuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com, tweet me at Arimithius, or join the Written and Uncertainty Discord. And if you want to check where I'm getting these ideas from, everything that I'm quoting will be on a blog post that accompanies this podcast at writtenuncertainty.com/Bosmer. And so with that, let's get to the Bosmer. The Bosmer are the elves of Valenwood. They are the closest thing that you'll get in the Elder Scrolls to traditional elves, in inverted commas. But even then, they don't really fit the mold. They live in a forest and they're proficient with bows, sure, but that's about it. They are strict carnivores and have very strict rules about which timber from their forest can and can't be used, and also cannibals when the need arises, which I don't think you'll see anywhere else in traditional elvish stuff. They also have a bunch of different sources of political authority, which isn't that usual, and we'll get to looking into those in quite a bit of depth later. I think the most defining feature of the Bosma, as opposed to other elves on Tamriel, is their veneration of Ifri, the first of the Oathbones, or Jifrei, as was first appeared in Daggerfall and in some of the later texts that are trying to reconcile the difference between Ifri and Jifrei, if I can put it that way. And just for convenience's sake, I will be referring to Ifri, except where Jifrei is explicitly brought up. They are quite different in how they're portrayed and put across, but I want to refer to Ifri just as the convenient shorthand. And as Ifri has a huge impact on the overall culture of the Bosma, I wanted to start with a description of him from Varieties of Faith. Quote, Ifri, god of the forest, the most important deity of the Bosmeri pantheon. While Auriel Time Dragon might be the king of the gods, the Bosma revere Ifri as the spirit of the now. According to the Wood Elves, after the creation of the mortal plane, everything was in chaos. The first mortals were turning into plants and animals and back again. Then Ifri transformed himself into the first of the Elnafei, or Earthbones. After these laws of nature were established, mortals had a semblance of safety in the new world because they could finally understand it. Ifri is sometimes called the Storyteller, for the lessons he taught the first Bosma. Some Bosma still possess the knowledge of the Chaos Times, which they can use to great effect, the Wild Hunt. That description has a lot of pieces in it that I want to unpack, but I will save most of it for later. In this world, I think that it's telling that this description came in with The Elder Scrolls III Morrowind. The Bosma are one of the cultures that got a fairly major reboot in the Pocket Guide to the Empire that was published with The Elder Scrolls Adventures Redguard. The Bosma's cannibalism and the Green Pact both date from the Pocket Guide, in the real world at least, which I believe is down to Michael Kirkbride's dislike of traditional wood elves. I remember hearing somewhere that he was basically, I don't like these things, let's make them eat each other, that'll teach them to be elves, that sort of thing. And just to give you an idea of the kinds of transitions that happened, we didn't have Ifri until after The Elder Scrolls II Daggerfall. As I said before, references before that are to Jifrei, who is the Green Singer, who named the Beast of the Field, but wasn't among the Earthbones in the same way that Ifri was. And now I think about it, I think that the very notion of the Earthbones comes in around this time as well. So they were slotted in to try and reinforce that notion of the Earthbones, as far as I can tell. The multiple sources of cultural authority came later in the game's development, and I think that's mostly down to what feels like different interpretations of the Wood Elf theme. I get the feeling that the Bosma have been seen as more of a blank canvas by Elder Scrolls developers than other races, and so we've had multiple different forms of history and mythology and other characters inflected onto them as a result. And that kind of theme of uncertainty is something that I want to kind of play into with the rest of this podcast, and I think the easiest place to begin that is looking at how they were created. And that uncertainty comes across most concretely in their creation myths, I think. There are two major creation myths for the Bosma, although it feels like some have only been hinted at, so there may also be more. There are two major creation myths for the Bosma, although looking at some of the sources, it feels like some aspects of them have only really been hinted at. So I'll do my best to unpack those as we go. We have a mundane creation myth for the Bosma, if I can call it that, and a fantastical one. I think it's mildly telling that we only have the mundane story from non-Bosma, but that could just be a coincidence. The best telling of the non-fantastical myth is from the book Valenwood, A Study, which comes from someone explicitly studying the Bosma from an outside culture. I didn't pick up enough from their name to be able to know where they were from precisely, but they're not Bosma. But they say this, quote, "Life for many in the Old Merry Dominion begins in Valenwood, green, forested, filled with a wide variety of plant and animal life, and home to some of the first elves from Old Elnafay, also called Eldmeris. Over time and through generations, these early settlers adapted to the woods. They learned stealth and cunning by studying their new prey. Eventually they became wood elves or Bosma. Slighter than the Altma, intense and agile, the Bosma are renowned archers and scouts." You see variations on this theme in a few places, that the Bosma left Eldmeris and came to Valenwood, and then became the Bosma when they arrived, or after they arrived. There is possibly an intermediate step here, as the book Arabic Enigma for the Elden Tree calls them the Boichi Elves, or Boichi, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, but Boichi Elves, rather than Bosma, before they made Green Sap their tower. The only other book that mentions Boichi as a term for the Bosma is the Daggerfall book The Wild Elves, and it treats Boichi as a synonym for Bosma. But Arabic Enigma at one point says Boichi become Bosma, which suggests that the Boichi was the stage before they were Bosma in some sense. And there's multiple ways that could go, so put a pin in it for now and we'll come back to it later. I seem to be saying that a lot today, I don't know why. But the fantastical creation myth is the one that I personally place the most stock in, because I think it links up better with other accounts and other myths around that sort of time, most notably the Khajiit creation myth as told in the words of clan mother Agnesi to her favoured daughter. The best tale that we have from a Bosma perspective of this is the tale The Ooze Fable, which says this, quote, "But Ifri took the ooze and ordered it. First she told of the green, the forests, and all the plant life in it. She gave the green the power to shape itself as it willed, for it was her first tale. The elves were Ifri's second tale. As Ifri spun the story, the elves took the form they have today. Ifri gave them the power to tell stories, but warned them against trying to shape themselves or the green. Shifting and the destruction of the forest were forbidden. Instead, Ifri commended the wood elves to the green, so that they might ask the green to provide them with shelter and a safe passage, and as long as they respected the green, it would obey. This is called the Green Pact." And this text ends with this, quote, "Any wood elf that violated the Green Pact, either by shifting or by damaging the green, would be condemned to return to the formlessness of the ooze. Their names would be scrubbed from the story Ifri is telling and replaced with silence." Now, the way this is told feels like it happens quite a bit earlier than the tale that simply has them split from Eldmeris. It holds that Ifri orders the world and then the Bosma, giving them shape where before they had no shape. And this happens while the world is being formed, so you're talking Dawn Era, or the very start of the Merithic Era. And the Khajiiti tale, just to marry them up a bit, says this, quote, "But Nurni soon forgave Lokarj, for Nurni could make children, and she filled herself with children, but cried because her favourite children, the forest people, did not know their shape. And Azura came to her and said, 'Poor Nurni, stop your tears. Azura makes for you a gift of a new people.' Nurni stopped weeping, and Azura spoke the first secret to the moons, and they parted and let Azura pass. And Azura took some of the forest people, who were torn between man and beast, and she placed them in the best deserts and forests on Nurni. And Azura, in her wisdom, made them of many shapes, one for every purpose. And Azura named them Khajiit, and told them her second secret, and taught them the value of secrets. And Azura bound the new Khajiit to the lunar lattice, as is proper for Nurni's secret defenders. Then Azura spoke the third secret, and the moon shone down on the marshes, and their light became sugar. But Yifa heard the first secret and snuck in behind Azura. And Yifa could not appreciate secrets, so he told Nurni of Azura's trick. So Nurni made the deserts hot and the sands biting, and Nurni made the forests wet and filled with poisons. And Nurni thanked Yifa and let him change the forest people also. And Ifur did not have Azura's subtle wisdom, so Ifur made the forest people elves always and never beasts. And Ifur named them Bosma, and from that moment they were no longer in the same litter as the Khajiit. In this tale, the Bosma and the Khajiit are both forest people, whatever that means, and they split off from other cultures before they were even elves. And one thing that's similar across both tales is that neither mentions Aldmeris. And as Aldmeris is the mythical origin point of all elves, these tales would imply that the Bosma are not in fact Myr, but something else. They are potentially another type of Elnafae, maybe, that doesn't get mentioned elsewhere, and this is going very much against the grain of the popular understanding of the Elnafae, which has everything as simply either the old or the wandering Elnafae that then became Myr and Men, respectively. But that distinction only really gets made in the Anuad, and if the Anuad isn't true, and there's part of me that thinks it's not that, or not strictly true anyway, it's a combination of a variety of different tales all smooshed together into one, then if that's the case, and you can't take the Anuad at its word as far as the Elnafae are concerned, then it's possible that the Bosma were some other form of Elnafae. We could have multiple types of Elnafae. And so this is possibly a little strange, though, because the Anuad was originally linked to the Bosma in its title and its development. It was originally called the Aelid / Bosmuri creation myth. But regardless of that, I think that if we disregard the Anuad's categorization of the Elnafae, then we have a good way of reconciling the two myths, so to speak, that the Bosma can come upon Valen Wood as Elnafae rather than as elves. Although there's also part of me that says that maybe those myths don't need to be reconciled. Maybe they both happened on some level. The Bosma are a people who put quite a bit of stock and power into stories, and that means that actual events can potentially be altered to some degree. Exactly how far isn't clear, but we have this passage from the Green Lady in a Loremaster's archive describing the power of the spinners. Quote, "A spinner's power is in the strength of his storytelling, fostered by talent and increased by experience. As you say, a great spinner can actually see the stories of the nearby world, and these stories can reveal the true natures of persons or objects. But to change a story, a spinner must engage its protagonist, who on some level must accept the new turns in the tale." Now this is both talking about spinners in general, but also relates quite directly to some events in the Elder Scrolls Online. The question, if I remember correctly, was in regards to a quest line that was talking about a single spinner affecting a single protagonist. But if there was a reason to change the whole tale of the Bosma as a culture, then spinners could potentially have changed Bosmeri history as well, or at least its perception of it, or at least the Bosmeri perception of it, if I can put it that way. There are indications that the settlement of Ooze, that's Ouze, that the Bosma were at some point at a crossroads. Several texts that describe the history of Ooze indicate that the Bosma changed from one story to another at some later point in their history, if I can put it that way. The book Oathbreakers of Ooze suggests that this was the result of the winners of some civil war or conflict, if I can put it that way, imposing their will on the losers. Quote, "The secret of Ooze is now clear. The Bosma, it appears, did not all accede to the Green Pact. Something happened. Civil war? A disagreement between their gods? It does not matter. One contingent of the Wood Elves lost to the other." Exactly what those factions are, I don't think we find out, but it's clear that one faction lost. There are several texts that link the Bosma to story and song. Remember how the Ooze fable says that the elves are Ifri's second tale? That their very nature is as a story? We also have a Hercene worshipper, probably a Bosma, call upon the people to, quote, rise up and reject the tyranny of shape and story in the text, The Blessings of Hercene. This means that the Bosma's origins are the maxim of history is written by the Vixers writ large. A victorious faction of Bosma won a war to determine what their culture was, and in doing so, changed the stories and possibly of the events of the past in doing so. That said, the Bosma are still subject to a meta-narrative of sorts. They're still subject to a degree of uncertainty and change that the elves are not, regardless of what they think their past is. This is expressed in the magic of the spinners, which, as I said earlier, can change history, or at least the perception of history, which is pretty much the same thing. That everything is so obviously mutable to the Bosma expresses a deeper truth, I think, that for them, history is whatever you make it. It doesn't really matter a whole lot. Ifri is the spirit of the now, according to the Bosma, remember, and so the past isn't necessarily a definite thing. They're only concerned with the now and what they're doing and how they're being in the moment rather than what has been. And their very nature seems to be grounded in uncertainty and change, in perchance. That's potentially defined by the Tower Greensap, or expressed as the Tower Greensap, or as we've talked about earlier, maybe both at once. And I think that's the truth behind truths for the Bosma, particularly given this passage from Arwic Enigma 4, quote, "The Boichi elves were of the earthbones who most hearkened to Geoffrey and his green songs. They did not build a tower, they grew it. A great grat oak whose roots sprang from a perchance acorn, and this was their stone. And because the acorn might perchance have been elsewhere, thus was green sap manifold and several, and each could walk. Therefore each green sap was also every green sap. Within each were told all of the stories of the green, with every ending true. So doors therein were not always doors certain. But to this the Boichi become Bosma became inured, and indeed grew to relish these doors equivocal, for such was their nature in the schism of the prism. In this way the Bosma learned which songs made the trees dance, and which dances they might do." Note that line towards the end, within each were told all the stories of the green, with every ending true. This indicates that all the stories are true, and therefore the Bosma can never be certain. All they can do is tell different stories. That does change slightly with Anumeril messing with the Stone of Green Sap, but the core principle still holds, I think. The Aeliads did not seek to change the schism of the prism, so to speak. That they didn't seek to alter the sundering of Old Meris, and so the core nature of the Bosma remained within the same set of parameters. And having mentioned Anumeril and the Aeliads, I should probably explain their relation to the Bosma, because I think they did have some impact on Bosmeri history. Several groups of Aeliads sought refuge in Valenwood following Alessia's victory in the year 242 of the First Era, and then began to interact with Bosma culture. The Anuad subtitle points to quite a bit of interaction between the Bosma and Aeliad culture, but the narrative of the Bosma subsumes that of the Aeliads, at least according to the book Aeliad Survivals in Valenwood. Quote, "These clans all worshipped at Daedric princes, but they seem to have done so with less fervour after their enforced migration to Valenwood, possibly due to the fact that the princes, when called upon, had offered little or no help to the Forsaken clans. Fortunately, their new hosts, the Bosma, were remarkably generous in welcoming the Aeliads into their realm, so long as the Heartland Elves agreed to adopt aspects of the Green Pact and refrained from harming the forest. Having little choice, the Aeliads agreed, and this probably contributed to the dilution of their culture. For diluted it was, absorbed over time, and eventually forgotten. I have walked the great Aeliad ruins of Valenwood, Hectorhaim, Rilaniel's Fall, Bellarata, Leiloria, and a dozen more, and none of them, not one, was still occupied only 2,000 years after the Diaspora. For some reason, once the Aeliads were under the great Grat Oaks, they, and their distinctive culture simply melted away. Arabic Enigma suggests that there was some degree of interaction the other way as well, though, that the aliens had an impact on the Bosma. Quote, Anumeril brought forth segment one among the roots and showed it to the golden nut, and this told an ending, so that the stone became a definite acorn. That Elden Tree would not walk again, but Anumeril had yet further intentions for it. Using his dentition as tonal instruments, he dismantled his bones and built of them a Mundus machine that mirrored Nern and its planets. And when he had used all his substance in fangling this orrery, he placed the segment scepter within, hiding it between the moons. Now, this indicates that the aliens messed with green sap to some degree, or at least with one instance of green sap, which then changed the nature of the Bosma to some small degree. The aliens influenced the Bosma story, and in doing so, changed Bosma culture. Green sap is still per chance, but it's changed. And I think that perchance is probably the best explanation, in universe at least, for the multiple sources of authority in Valen Wood, unless we want to simply chalk things up to the out of universe explanation that I talked about earlier. There are several places that the Bosma can get authority from, and they're all seemingly coming from different points in the Bosma social fabric. Whatever the Bosma are, it's not something that's determined by their rulers, rather it's the other way around in my opinion. The source of authority that gets the most attention is the Sylvanar and the Green Lady. These two represent the duality, the contradictions of the Bosma people. The Sylvanar is an expression of the elves and the order of Valen Wood, while the Green Lady is described as a force of nature in quite a few places. And I think it's telling that there's also a city in Valen Wood called Sylvanar as well. The Sylvanar is a sympathetic expression of the Bosma and their civilized nature particularly, and also a lever to change and affect the Bosma people as a whole, if the book The Voice of the People is to be believed. The in-universe novel A Dance in Fire implies that he makes laws, but we don't really see that when we get to meet the Sylvanar and see the politics of Valen Wood at work in ESO too much, although the Sylvanar is documented to have represented the Bosma and Valen Wood to the Dominion, which I would have kind of expected the Camoran King to be the one making the more formal representation. One thing I see as a possibility for why that is that the Sylvanar is whatever the Bosma need him or her even to be at the time, and if they needed to make diplomatic overtures to foreign powers, it's the Sylvanar that does it. If that's not needed, then they won't. That's the best explanation that I can come to on why it wasn't the Camoran dynasty representing the Bosma, but if there's any culture where I think it's okay for the edges of authority to be fuzzy, it will be the Bosma. If the Sylvanar is the representation of the Bosma, then I think the Green Lady is the representation of Valen Wood, with the feral nature of the forest as a core part of her. We don't have too much written down on the Green Lady, but her state when the Sylvanar is assassinated implies that the nature of the Green Lady is unleashed, so to speak. Part of it is likely grief for the loss of her ordained mate, but it also feels like the presence of the Sylvanar holds the Green Lady in balance and tames the wildness of the forest, if I can put it that way, which has all sorts of, I don't know, interesting connotations if you want to look at the traditional way that that some relationships have been formed throughout human history, or at least told stories about the idea of someone being a civilized influence on their partner, although it's typically the other way around. It's typically that the gentle nature of the woman and stuff is there to tame the unbridled passions of the man and all this, that, and the other. I don't think that that's necessarily a deliberate thing on the part of ESO's developers when they came up with these concepts, but it kind of feels a bit that way, and possibly a bit icky, but well, less icky because the genders have been flipped, if I can put it that way. But also the kind of the interplay between the elves and the forest is expressed in the Sylvanar and the Green Lady. And so when the Sylvanar is dead, that balance is knocked out, and so the feral nature of the forest takes over. I suppose I should also point out here, though, that the physicality and the feral nature of the Green Lady is sometimes attributed to the Bosmer rather than Valenwood as a province. I'm more inclined to go with her being an expression of Valenwood rather than an expression of the Bosmer, but you can make arguments both ways. So, that's preference, I guess. And the book, The Eldest, A Pilgrim's Tale, suggests that the Sylvanar and the Green Lady are a couple that tended to an ancient strangler plant in their old age, while A Tale Forever Told suggests that the Sylvanar and the Green Lady were mystically joined when they met. Their origins are a little fuzzy. A Tale Forever Told also has the Sylvanar named as the Sylvanar before the pairing with the Green Lady. That could just be the nature of the tale, that it's a given that these two will come together and be what they are, and that's kind of assumed by the structure of the story. But if the Sylvanar title was there before the match with the Green Lady, then it could be more of an expression of the Sylvanar as a mystic being joining with the wilder sides of the Green, and that's certainly the way that A Tale Forever Told pans out, that they're both expressions of something very similar, and that's why they're selected to be joined. And it's A Tale Forever Told that makes it certain that the first Green Lady is a Bosmer and not just a personification of Valenwood, if I can put it that way. And going from the wild pairing of the Bosmer and Valenwood to the relations of the Mer to everyone else, I think it's probably time we talked about the Camoran dynasty for a bit. The Camoran dynasty has been present in Valenwood for pretty much all of recorded history. Indeed, the Nords apparently used the founding of the Camoran dynasty to start their calendar for the first era. So it's the Camoran dynasty represent, at least for the Nords, a transition from myth to history, if I can put it that way. And despite this very definite beginning, and we do have the name of the founder of the Camoran dynasty written down and his achievements and so on, they're fairly loose in the sources we have, but I assume they're more thoroughly documented in the lore itself, actually in the world, because the books that we get aren't all of the books on Tamriel. There's no way they're all the books in Tamriel. So I think there will be more documentation around that than what we have. And despite that kind of line in the sand of this is where history starts sort of thing, the dynasty itself is quite a loose confederation that the third edition pocket guide notes has to be loose given how Valenwood is. That may mean that the Spinners and the Tree Thanes have a relatively large amount of authority on their own, independently from the dynasty itself. The Camoran dynasty serves less as a seat of direct rulership than a sort of nominal root that can potentially be refreshed or drawn from whenever Valenwood and the Bosmer needs to have a central authority. They don't really seem to have a whole heap of power on their own. They kind of negotiate and arbitrate between the factions in Valenwood. And as with the Sylvanar, it's when the Bosmer need it that the Camoran dynasty can step up and perform a function, and that's generally being in interaction with other elements on Tamriel. The Camoran dynasty may also perform a diplomatic function simply by being a dynasty. It's been leveraged by the Altmer at the very least, just simply because it's there. We have this passage from the first edition pocket guide, quote, "Formerly divided into the two realms of the Somerset Isles and Valenwood, the Aldmeri Dominion has its origins in Common Era 830, when the heirs of the Camarin dynasty began to fight over the Valenwood throne, when a faction of the Bosmer wood elves made overtures of peace to their longtime enemies in West Cyrodiil, territorial concessions in return for Calovian support for the faction's claimant, the Ultmer High Elves of Somerset invaded the Valenwood nations. Citing a stewardship clause in a treaty from 1,000 years before, the High Elves quickly established a provisional government, the Thalmor, on behalf of their own claimant, Camorin Anaxemes, whose bloodline had struck the pact with the Eldmeri Council in the first place. However, I think it's debatable that the dynasty has much authority beyond those sorts of functions. There is another source of authority within Bosmer culture that we touched on a little, but run throughout the whole thing and is kind of pulling the strings, so to speak, or is the ocean in which all the other forms of authority swim. That's the priesthood of Ifri and the Green Pact itself. I think this is best summed up with this quote from the book The Wood Elves of Valenwood, quote, "The Bosmeri race is governed, if one can describe this loose hegemony as such, by the royal Camarin dynasty, but there seems little rigidity or exertion of jurisdiction among the disorganized tribes of the Bosmer. Only slightly more stringent are the clan lines, which are matrilineal in nature. Ruled by the tree thane or head tribesmen, these serve little purpose other than providing protection during times of war. The real power is wielded by the priests of the forest deity Ifri, known as spinners, who enforce the Green Pact, a bizarre code of conduct forcing the Bosmer to feed carnivorously and never use living vegetation of any kind for any means. The true power over what the Bosmer are is determined by the spinners and the Green Pact. The spinners get to determine what makes a Bosmer through the Green Pact. We've already discussed how the Green Pact made the Bosmer into a distinct people in ages past, but I think that also that this wasn't a one-time event, that it's a process that is ongoing and changing as Bosmeri culture goes through time. And certainly we still have transgressors from the pact, and these aren't necessarily wiped out or subject to the same sort of metaphysical transformations as the fable of the ooze suggests, unless it wasn't a metaphysical transformation. There's a quest in ESO that suggests that a bunch of Bosmer who didn't agree with the Green Pact, the Oathbreakers. There's a quest in ESO that suggests that a bunch of Bosmer who didn't agree with the Green Pact, possibly the original ones who disagreed, the Oathbreakers, were just cast out and buried. The book Why We Farm gives some solid support to this sort of idea. Quote, "We planted and sowed and were going to harvest until we were found out and cast down here beneath the surface to die for our transgression against the Green Pact." Now, this shows the Oathbreakers being buried rather than returning to formlessness, which is what the fable would have you believe. The quest in ESO also highlights that ooze is a place rather than a state of being, and you meet spirits of the Bosmer who didn't agree with the Green Pact as part of that quest line. I've seen these beings called changelings on the UESP, and their apparent abilities would match that description, but I'm hesitant to say that all changelings are unreformed Bosmer without any solid evidence to back that up. We don't get to talk to Celine about her origins, for example. She's never that forthcoming about precisely what she is beyond changeling, and there's only a few other examples that I don't think we ever get to talk to. But either way, this shows that the reversion to formlessness isn't necessarily a punishment, just a group of Bosmer who refused to sign up to the Green Pact. And I think that means that the Green Pact is a form of social power rather than necessarily something that's metaphysical. The Green Lady's Loremaster's Archive that I referred to earlier does seem to back this up, because it puts the power of the spinners in quite social terms. Quote, "The second tenet you mention is better known as the meat mandate, but how strictly it is followed varies from tribe to tribe and indeed from individual to individual. However, dairy products, honey, mushrooms and insects are eaten with zest by all but the most ultra-zealous of packed Bosmer." This means that if you can persuade your spinner that something is acceptable according to the pact, then it's okay to do something according to the pact. The main focus of the pact seems to be to define the Bosma, and the extent of what that definition is will vary from place to place. I see this a bit like a distinction between statute and common law, if I can put it that way. The law books, that is statute law, say one thing, but if a precedent exists in a particular interpretation of the law, common law or case law, as it's referred to in some places, then that's good too, that both will be used to render a judgment by the spinners. So the spinners and the stories they tell act as living sources of precedent, which can be changed and added to as the spinners see fit. Now, this makes spinners the guardians or gatekeepers of Bosma cultural identity, both by enforcing the Green Pact and telling stories about the Bosma. And this constructs a social identity and a body of practice to go along with it. And the two then inform each other. And I think the Green Pact also potentially acts as a form of social contract as a result, which is implied in the name, I think. It's a pact, it's an agreement. This is at its most obvious with the Wild Hunt, I think, where the Bosma can revert back to the formlessness of before in order to protect themselves and the green. This reminds me of a concept from Thomas Hobbes, who I've talked about before on this podcast in relation to the Dunmer. The thing that I wanted to talk about here is that Hobbes believed that people give over their personal autonomy to a sovereign who then exercises violence against others in order to protect them. We've seen some sources that say that the green will give way to the Bosma and protect the Bosma earlier, so I can already see some similarities here. But one wrinkle of Hobbes's formulation is that he believed that when people were sentenced to death by the state, they were no longer protected by the sovereign and were therefore entirely within their rights to struggle, fight, and kill any agents of the state who went after them. And so that notion of the outlaw is what this is a formulation of. It's a formulation of someone who is outside the law, a suspension of civil relations that then allows violence towards and expects violence from those outside the civil system. I hope that's not too much of a leap to see how that relates to the Wild Hunt and the Green Pact. If the Green Pact and the forest can't protect the Bosma, then the pact between Ifri and the elves becomes void, and they can revert to being able to shapeshift in order to protect themselves. It's that return to natural relations unmediated by the sovereign, which is in this case the Green Pact. I hope that goes some way to showing that what the Bosma are is not in any way settled. It's an ongoing story, a conversation that began when what would become the Bosma began to have a conversation with the forests of Valenwood. Exactly what that conversation was and when it began has several different answers, but I think the Bosma would agree that the conversation as it's happening now is what matters, and that's ongoing. It's something that will shift and change, and so the Bosma cultural and physical identity will shift and change with it. Thank you ever so much for joining me in this bit of a ramble and slightly malformed, possibly, look at the Bosma and what they are and their culture. I do hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any questions at all about this, drop me a line at writtenanduncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. Or if you have anything that you want me to start looking into for future episodes, also get in touch with me there or find me on Twitter. Any of the methods you can find in the show notes. I would absolutely love to hear from you guys. And as I mentioned, this is the last podcast of 2020. So I will see you in a few months when I can pull myself back together and get all my notes settled for a decent release schedule. And until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius and edited and mixed by Dopportunity. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.
Have you ever wanted to learn more about geography without sitting through a snoozy old lecture? Geography Arcade is a weekly podcast all about your favorite video games and their geographic lessons, inspirations, and even some minor analysis. Some may say analysis, boo! Well, we're gonna learn and have fun while we talk about Pokemon, Elder Scrolls, and much more. Come join the adventure at Geography Arcade on your favorite podcatcher and YouTube.
Ahoy there, ye landlubbers! Avast! My name is Captain Logan, and I'll be your guide out on the Sea of Thieves. If you love the idea of stealing treasure, cutting down cursed skeletons, fighting off krakens, and raiding forts filled to the brim with shinies, then Sea of Thieves is the game for you. Join me each week as I dive into the news and bring back the nuggets of information that any sailor worth their weight in salt would desire. You don't have to be a pirate legend to gain access to my podcast. Just search for Keelhauled, a Sea of Thieves podcast in your podcast app of choice, or head over to robotsradio.net or captainlogan.podbeam.com and get ready to set sail for adventure. Arrgh.